If there's one pesticide just about everyone can name, it's DDT. And when the U.S. government finally banned DDT in 1972, it was viewed as a great victory for the environment. But did you know that a tiny island off the Leelanau Peninsula played a huge role in getting DDT banned? Well, technically, the seagulls who live on Gull Island helped get DDT banned. Jeff Smith is a writer and editor of Traverse Magazine. His story on Gull Island is in the May issue of the magazine. He joins us now from Interlochen Public Radio's studios. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Cynthia. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. And thanks. We welcome Dr. James Ludwig. He's had a long and very distinguished career studying bird population dynamics. And as a young grad student at the University of Michigan in the 1960s, it was his research that was the first to prove DDT was affecting the shells of herring gull eggs on Gull Island. Welcome, Dr. Ludwig. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Jeff, what is the story that you wanted to tell us in this piece you wrote called What the Gulls Tell?
You know, one thing I have always loved about magazine journalism is it does allow a story to be kind of represented and told at a number of levels. And I just think this story is just such a great representation of that. And I think at the most basic level, it's just a great tale of a big who knew about a tiny little scrape of rock out in Grand Traverse Bay, and it's covered by a gazillion gulls. And it's a very just obscure, anonymous little piece of rock, but it played this very outsized role in our policy and actually helped change our nation's laws. And in that sense, it was just an amazing story to tell. But I think, you know, some other layers in there are kind of equally important. And one of those is that this story really reinforces that idea that baseline research is just really essential to our understanding of nature and kind of guiding our way forward as we deal with all these different chemicals and changes in our environment. And I think that's a very, very important tale to tell that gets drowned out in today's, you know, very divisive political environment. And then I think the other thing is, and this is equally important, I think it's super important that the Great Lakes has a very devoted fan base. And I think a story like this helps connect people to the Great Lakes in both an intellectual way, in terms of like the natural resource info and learning about Dr. Ludwig's research and other researchers, and also in an emotional way, in the sense of like you just kind of really buy into those gulls and this environment, and you want to protect it. And so I think all those layers kind of wrap into that story, and that's a lot to try to achieve with the story. But luckily, this story is so rich and wonderful that I really think it was able to, you know, get to that point.
We ought to note that the official name of Gull Island is Bellow Island, but all the locals call it Gull Island. How far back do we think gulls have been on Bellow Island?
It's very likely that gulls have been nesting there for millennia. So that island's been there, is extant, about the size it is, for at least 2,000 years. It's very likely they've been there ever since.
Mm. You know, I think to a lot of us, Dr. Ludwig, gulls are kind of, yeah, they're always there. They're around the water. Maybe they're kind of a nuisance. Help us understand why it is so important to study the gull, why it's important for biologists and environmentalists to study. What are they telling us?
Well, the herring gull is the one we're talking about here. The most common one is the ring-billed gull now, but years ago, herring gulls were the dominant species in the system. And the reason it's important to study them is they're year-round residents. They live the entire year once they're adults. They spend it only on the Great Lakes. And they're a relatively large bird. They live a long time. So they turn out to be very good monitors over the long term of what's going on in the lakes. Food increases, their population goes up. Food decreases, it goes down, for example. But it's important because if you don't understand the direction that the whole system is headed in, you can overlook things very quickly. And that was one of the parts of the DDT story, that it was going on for almost two decades before it showed up in the gulls. And when it did, it showed up with a huge impact.
There you were, Dr. Ludwig. You're a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and you're up there studying. Can you take us back to that moment? What was going on, and when you had that realization that the DDT was indeed impacting the gull eggs?
Dad and grandfather had been going out there for over 20 years banding gull chicks. And over the next 15 years, I went every year to that island. We'd go out typically Memorial Day weekend, and we'd band as many herring gull chicks as we could. And over the period from 1949 to 1963, that particular colony was the most successful colony in the Great Lakes. And the banding records showed us that Belleau Island was exporting birds to many other colonies in the Great Lakes, as well as maintaining itself. That was a time period up until about 1963-64 where the colony actually increased in numbers every year that I can recall being there up until 1963. In 63, we banded about 2,500 chicks there in one day, a group of three of us. 1964, we went and the numbers of chicks fell off and we started seeing some broken eggs. I didn't know what they were, and I happened to meet a fellow who came to give a seminar at Michigan from University of Wisconsin. His name is Joe Hickey, a very famous ornithologist. And Joe mentioned that he'd seen something similar over in Green Bay. So Joe got together a grant and hired me to go out in 1965 and actually look at all the eggs on the island, count them up, find out how many were broken, collect a set for pesticide analysis. And at the same time all this was going on, people were starting to see it all over the world. Derek Ratcliffe over in the United Kingdom was seeing it in peregrine falcons. Charles Broly down in the Florida area was seeing it in bald eagles. And all these threads were starting to come together. Basically, what we found was that almost a third of the eggs that were laid at Belleau Island in 1965 were cracked and broken open. And ultimately, the productivity there was about one-third what it was out in the Beaver Islands. And as you must know, there's a lot of cherry orchards and apple orchards around the bay. We began to suspect that it was DDT.
It's such a big moment in environmental science. Jeff, tell us then, how was Dr. Ludwig's research used and how did it help spell the end of DDT in America?
Well, as Congress began to debate these sort of things at the dawn of the environmental movement, they turned to science to see if there's actual proof of this. And Dr. Ludwig's study was one of just a handful, as I understand it, of studies that were used to help convince Congress that DDT had to go. You know, miraculously, Congress back then, I think, was a little more unified in the support of the environment and was open to more even-handed assessment of science. Again, just this tiny scrape of land. And to see it, I mean, it's a nothing. It's really a nothing. It's just covered with bird poop and scrubby growth and a bunch of dried-up bird nests. And to stand there and think about that, that this very obscure little place and the research that came from that helped convince Congress of something very important is just a very momentous thing. I don't know if Dr. Ludwig wants to expand on that at all.
Well, I can a little bit. It's important to understand how regulation was done prior to 1972. Up until 1972, the Department of Agriculture was in charge of regulating pesticides. That changed with the passage of a law called FIFRA, which was the Fungicide, Insecticide, Rodenticide Control Act of 1972, and that transferred control to the US EPA. Up until that time, you might think of it this way. The fox was in charge of the hen house. Department of Agriculture, that really did not want to regulate pesticides any more than absolutely necessary, had been very recalcitrant and unwilling to deal with the problem until the law was changed. And when it was changed and got over to EPA, a fellow named Charlie Worcester from State University of New York solicited affidavits to be used in the case against DDT, and Belleau Island was one of the cases that was chosen. It played a very significant role, I think, in getting the pesticide banned and also probably in the reformation of the law itself.
Jeff Smith, you make such a good point in the story you wrote for Traverse Magazine that the kind of research that Dr. Ludwig and his colleagues do year in and year out can seem kind of ho-hum, maybe pointless, and, as you point out, easily the target of budget cuts.
That's right. we all know about William Proxmire's Golden Fleece Awards. He actually ridiculed a separate gull study at one point a while ago where a researcher was showing that two females would share a nest. And this researcher was, you know, connecting this to chemical contamination. And as you can imagine, if you have two females in a nest, there's a lot less likely to be offspring, trying to express very nuanced changes in the environment. And William Proxmire was able to hold this up, call it the gay seagull study, try to get the funding cut. And sadly, that kind of thing can drive policy, right?
Yeah.
And this kind of study, where they just go out every spring, another researcher that plays very prominently in the story, Dr. William Scharf, has been going out there every spring for 46 years to count the number of eggs in nests, to measure the size of those eggs, to take 13 eggs and have them saved for chemical contaminant analysis. And this is happening every year on some slim little grant, you know, borrowing a boat from the tribe up there and, you know, getting permission from the Land Conservancy and all this. It's very unsexy stuff, you know, and
yeah.
You're out there being, you're being pooped on by birds and pecked and they're squawking at you. And yet, you know, when suddenly there's a change, then it becomes some of the most important stuff that our culture can really be doing right now. And the amazing thing is really, for as humble as that little island is, you know, we have Dr. Ludwig's example with DDT. We had a more recent example where cormorants have really surged in population on the Great Lakes and were driving out long-term populations of other birds like the herring gull, and that evidence was presented based on this baseline research. And the cormorants were not eliminated, but their numbers were brought way down, so the herring gulls had a better chance and even more connected to the chemical contaminant issue. Bromides were, these are fire retardants, were showing up. They're very persistent chemicals and were showing up in the gull eggs, and there were detrimental results were being seen, and they were able to use that evidence to have restrictions on that chemical play. So it's not just a one-off, you know, mm-hmm. the DDT thing. I mean, it's an ongoing thing, and yet it still takes that, just that yearly or whatever kind of commitment it is to get out there and just get the boring stuff so when the big change happens, you know, we can see it.
Dr. Ludwig, when you look into the future, what challenges do you see ahead for the scientists who are following in your path?
Continuity. And by continuity, I mean continuity of funding. If you look at the kind of research that was done on a place like Bellot Island, really that started with my father and grandfather back in the 1930s and has continued with Bill Scharf's activities and other people working on these islands, you find that there's been minuscule funding for decades and virtually none for the last two decades. The only program that's really been continued has been the herring gull egg monitoring program that the Canadian Wildlife Service established and included American sites back about 46 years ago. And what we're seeing now is, particularly the last 20 years, we're seeing a reduction in field research. What we do now is we model everything, and modeling is only as good as the assumptions and is only as good as the fundamental baseline data used to make the model. And unfortunately, we have defaulted to this way of doing science, and it's not working. Jeff mentioned this female-female pairing problem that Senator Proxmire ridiculed so effectively. Well, it turns out that is one of the key pieces of information that is now being shown to be important in the endocrine disruptor debate, because it turns out DDT is a potent estrogen. And as a potent estrogen, one of the ways you got female-female pairings to occur was that a significant number of those birds are actually hermaphrodites, or birds that are genetic males that got exposed to enough DDT embryonically that they turned into phenotypic females, and they're not fertile. So what happens now is that particular problem, because those birds live so long, continues on for several decades after the chemicals are moved from commerce. It doesn't change quickly. And that's the kind of thing that we absolutely have to have. Research done year after year after year, and it's the mundane, common kind of research that turns out to be important.
Dr. James Ludwig and Jeff Smith, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Much enjoyed it.
I did too.
Jeff Smith's story, What the Gulls Tell, can be found in the May issue of Traverse Magazine. And Jeff joined us from the studios of Interlochen Public Radio.